All right, Alexander, we are here with Stanislav. Stanislav, how are you doing? Where can people follow your work?
Doing good. Okay, so on X, you can follow me on at Stanis Krapivnik. Couldn't get the whole name in there, so not enough space. I'm on YouTube at Mr. Slavic Man, Slavic with a K, and Telegram. The English language channel, Stas, was there. The Russian language channel, Stas, Today I brought night, and on Substack at zmeygarinich.substack.com.
All right. I have those links. Yeah. I have those links. If you're not already following Stanislav, I have those links in the description box down below and as a pinned comment. So Alexander, Stanislav, let's talk about the energy situation, or should we say the energy crisis, Alexander, Stanislav, possibly energy lockdowns, maybe? Let's talk about it.
I think energy crisis is far too weak a word to describe what is going on. At least if you're living in Britain, where we're now talking about the fact that we are, we are definitely now heading towards blackouts, rationing, and all of those things, and which is causing tremors and worries for many, many people, as I know. There is absolutely nobody better to discuss this topic with than Stanislav, who has actually worked in this industry and who knows it backwards and who can describe to us exactly what is going on. So first of all, is the situation as bad as I said? Am I being alarmist? Or on the contrary, is it governments that are being complacent? I say complacent because, of course, if you listen to the European Commission, there's absolutely nothing to worry about. We have the situation completely under control. We learned an awful lot from the 2022 energy crisis, energy-ish problems, which, of course, we discounted and said that they weren't that serious at the time. But, you know, we've learned a lot from that problem, and this time it will be a lot easier. What is the truth?
Well, first of all, I'm not just a pretty war face. Just so the audience knows, I was a supply chain director, junior supply chain director, and then supply chain director for both regional for Eurasia in Cameron and Halliburton. So I worked with all these suppliers of pipe and valves for the oil field. So I know their cycles of manufacturing. And then I was a supply chain director in an EPC company called Tecnomont, which is an Italian company, on the project. So I was in charge of the procurement and the logistics on each of these projects. And the two projects we covered when I was working there, we were expanding the refinery in Moscow to produce E95 petro. And we were building one of the three phases of the giant LNG plant in Amur. So I know how long this stuff takes. I know how many vessels, for example, long it takes to make vessels just to get that extra, portion of the refinery to refine up to E95. We have about 120 vessels in this section, and vessels, I mean, you get these tubes that have the chemical processes happening in them. Granted, the majority were 1 to 3 meters long. But there were two, there were 78 meters long, and all of this is produced by hand. And you're looking at, you're looking at long-term manufacturing that goes into this. This is just to expand that one portion of the refinery was a year and a half project, plus metal construction that has to go in there for latticing to hold everything up. So we're talking, you know, very, very serious investment and very, very serious materials. Now, having said that, it's not a catastrophe. It is a collapse. I mean, because in 22, it was a self-made painful moment because you had two things going for you. One, you had the stupidity of politicians that said, hey, we saw on the spot market yesterday that prices were lower than on this contract. We're going on the spot market. But if you looked at it instead of just yesterday to say an entire month, you'd see that 90% of the time it's higher than what you have on the contract. So all these politicians that have no economics background, have no concept of how spot markets work, they all decided to go on spot market because they get better prices than a fixed rate contract. When reality kicked in and no, it's actually much higher normally because spot market is something you go out to buy an emergency, procure emergency supplies. So yes, the vast majority of the time, you're there instead of a long-term planning, oh my God, you know, I need that extra pound of flour versus the flour I've been thinking of. So I'm going to go to that convenience store and buy that flour. It's going to cost you, of course, a hell of a lot more than if you had a constant flow of flour coming in and you're buying or paying for volume. That's what spot markets are for, in this case, energy. So it's part of, and the other part is, oh, it's evil Russian gas. It's tyranny molecules. We want freedom molecules. So all of this was created in a vacuum, but it was created not because there was a lack of supply, but because of political, very stupid political decisions. There is not enough supply now. Quite literally, you can pay whatever money you want, but if it isn't there on the market, it's just not there. So we've watched somewhere between 20-25% of the world's oil supply go off market. That's it. It's gone. It's no longer being pumped or produced in a lot of these areas. So it's not a total collapse because Saudi Arabia is still shipping about 5 million barrels per day out of its Red Sea ports. That is, if Yemen doesn't destroy them, which is now part of this conflict as of 2 days ago. And then Iran is still shipping some amount of oil out, but the vast majority is offline, or the workers have fled for obvious reasons, so on. And then flat out, over 20% of LNG is just gone, and is gone long term, because it's not just a shutdown. I mean, I looked at the pictures of the damage done by the Iranian missiles. In my view, that's a year and a half to 2 years of clearing. I mean, what could go into this? You got to clear the damage, first of all. Figure out what it is. Clear the damage out. You know, all the metal constructs that are now been twisted, been damaged, they're only good for chopping them up and taking them to the scrapyard and smelting them down for something new. The vessels, everything like that, the same thing. And there's going to be possibly a hell of a lot more than 140 vessels that need to be replaced there. Maybe hundreds of vessels, depending on how big of a process this is. True, LNG is a little bit different than creating gasoline. It needs less, but still, there's a lot of equipment that's been destroyed that needs to be replaced. And this equipment, a lot of this equipment is made to order. It's not necessarily sitting on a shelf somewhere. So it has a lead time between order and construction. And that's if, by the way, if it's just the above ground equipment that's damaged. If the wellheads are damaged, if the fountains or Christmas trees, depending which side of which countries call it what, but if they're damaged, they have to be replaced. And most of those, while the valves are mass produced, a lot of the Christmas trees are built to order for a specific wellhead. So they have to be replaced. Okay, granted, that can be done in a few months. But if the well itself is damaged, how well damaged is it? Did the pipe collapse in there and you have to re-drill the pipe out and pull it out with magnets, with drill bits that you spin in there, and then you pull the damaged pipe out, then you have to get the new pipe in, possibly re-drill parts of it. Or if it's very seriously damaged, you cap that well and you drill a new one. That's, by the way, a lot of extra time. That's 2-3 months to drill a new well. Just to get the equipment in, get it set up, drill the well, and that's one well. You know, how many wells have been destroyed? How many wells have been seriously damaged? I don't know. Nobody knows, because I'm doubtful that they've gone through yet and done an actual serious audit, which of course will take time in itself. So you're starting to look at, you know, further and further restart timelines. How long is it going to take? We don't know. We don't know what the end damage is going to be yet, because this conflict is not over. There may be a hell of a lot more damage done before this is over. And then you start looking at other factors. You need a workforce. The majority of that workforce, the high-end workforce, to be honest, in the Persian Gulf countries, are Americans and Brits. That's the majority of them. There are other countries that come in there. Obviously, Russia has a lot of them, but nobody – they're American and Brits. I doubt that they're going to ask for Russian companies to come in there. Russia and China will be propping Iran back up on its feet. No doubt about that. But the Persian Gulf, there's a big question with that. Then there's a question, you know, in Saudi Aramco, you know, the majority of Saudi Aramco is American engineers, American high-tech workers. Maybe not all the a lot of field hands may be local, but the more professional crews are almost all Americans. They are there with their families. Their families just got dropped by the U.S. government and told, survive the best you can. You think most of those families are going to want to come back? So there's going to be possibly a lot of workers that you can't get back in. And that's if there's infrastructure for the workers, such as, you know, desalination plants. These countries are built in the dust. They're artificial entities. They, before oil and gas and everything started building up, there might have been small villages there. You know, I was, when I was in Dubai, I was looking for historic Dubai, couldn't find historic Dubai, started talking to the locals saying, ah, historic Dubai. It was a mud brick fort with a small village and a couple piers. That was historic Dubai. There is no historic Dubai. It's a village until it grew into a giant city of several million people. And again, how do you support that if you don't have desalination plants, if you can't import food? So you start to see these cascades of problems that you got to solve before you can get everything up and running. Get the right workforce in. Start putting in engineering drawings. Start getting an engineering work done on what needs to be done. And then start ordering with lead times. Because believe you me, you know, steel takes a while to get done. You order steel, specific versions of steel, by the way, specific alloys. It could be anywhere from a month and a half to 3 months before you get the steel that you need to then forge into those valves, and then the valves have to be machined, and that is rarely it's at the same location, and so on, and so, and tested for pressure testing, and so on. So they have serious lead times on this. And while parts of this equipment is made on shelf to go on shelf to sell, nobody, you know, it's made a shelf for newer projects or replacement of older equipment, so you have a certain volume. Now, you've blown through every bit of that volume instantly with this. Because this, the volumes of damage already are insane. Nobody prepared for something on this scale. And then, this could be this. And I'm not even going into fertilizer yet, and starvation. That's a whole different kind of issue there too. But just on the oil and gas, we could be looking for a year and a half to 2 years at a minimum of all of this being online or partially offline. Before it's online. And if it continues, it could be 5, 6, 7, 8 years at least. And that there's money to do this.
That's actually okay. That actually brings me to something that I was told last year in the summer by an oil industry engineer, which is that attacking oil refineries does only a limited amount of damage to an industry, because refineries are very resilient. They can be repaired very quickly. You can, depending obviously on the extent of the damage, but a refinery that is attacked, they're big facilities, but you can get them back up and running within a few weeks. Whereas if you destroy the actual oil extraction facilities, the oil and gas production facilities, what brings this out of the ground, that is a totally different question. That actually does lead to a crisis. And even shutting down production for a certain period of time without any physical damage being done, you know, in the terms of missiles and drones landing and that kind of thing, that in itself causes damage over time. And if it is prolonged too long, then getting the oil fields, the oil extraction back up and running again, that becomes a very serious problem. And it can take weeks and months and sometimes years to do, again, depending on the resources that you put in. Is that correct? Is that a correct assessment?
It is. By the way, at the wellhead, it's a lot easier to switch off oil. You can close the wellheads on oil. Gas is a much bigger problem. Refineries, yes, to a degree. First of all, what you see, a lot of the strikes, the Ukrainians, when they're hitting Russian refineries, they're not hitting the refineries. They're hitting the oil storage facilities, which are actually very easy to replace. It's just a big drum with a roof that goes up and down under volume to keep the pressure up. They burn really well because it's just full of oil. Nobody's going to put it out until it burns out. There's no point in trying to put it out. And it makes for a pretty picture for, you know, look what damage we've done. Versus hitting pipes, which are all computer monitored. They're all pressurized. And the moment something goes awry, the computer will switch off, will close the valves at certain points. So no more fuel is going down that damaged pipe. So the fires get controlled very quickly. Again, though, depending on what's hit, you know, you take out a 78 meter or 80 meter long vessel, like some of the ones that we were producing in Tambov for Moscow. You know, try, but it would transport that vessel. It's all handmade, so it has to be the pipe has to be created for size. Everything has to be welded on separately, cut separately, tested, retested. It gets filled up with water under pressure. Deck gets pumped out. Has to be dried and cleaned. Then it's moved. You know, try moving it at 78-meter long vessel, which by the way has a truck that makes it even longer. We literally were lifting buildings, smaller buildings, with giant cranes off their foundations to get this thing off into toward the interstate. And there are parts of roads that they can't go under because of bridges or something and a dip that would actually ground it right in there. So it's a logistics nightmare to begin with. And then getting it in, and when you get it into a refinery area, before you can put it up, you have to test it for pressure again, which is, again, you pour all the water in there. I mean, 78, that's quite a bit of water. You pump it out, you dry it all up, and then you start putting it on the infrastructure that you've already built with a metal construction. That all takes a lot of time. And that's counting that this was being moved from Tambov to Moscow, which is about 500 kilometers. Now let's see who can manufacture this equipment for the Persian Gulf. Well, Russia can, China can, US can, to a smaller degree, India and Brazil can. That's pretty much so it for these companies. And these companies also have a certain amount of volume because they have internal business, obviously, in the countries. And now all of a sudden you have just gigantic demands coming in because how much damage has actually been done? If one of these vessels is pierced, you can't weld it back shut. It's never going to hold the same amount of pressure anymore. It's a weak point. A weld will always be a weak point. It's one thing when you're in a valve, it's welded and bolted together. It's a whole different thing when it's on a piece of the pipe itself that makes this big vessel that's been pierced. You pretty much can't do a lot with that after that. You clean it up and you scrap it. You clean it up from the chemicals that's in it, unless you really want to pollute your environment. And again, and any damaged infrastructure has to be taken apart, has to be cut, taken apart, bring in new girders build it back up so you can hang everything on. It's an insane amount of logistics that goes in there. And now if you're having to bring that in from the U.S. or, you know, forget Europe. Europe will never be able to make anything again until it has cheap gas, really cheap gas, and cheap steel from Russia, because German steel and everything is massively expensive. The German Union of Steelmakers about 2 years ago proposed to the government that they take the sanctions off of Russian steel so they can get enough steel to produce 155-millimeter artillery rounds to shoot a Russian. I'm pretty sure they were actually serious about that. But that's the point, though. The Germans, you know, all of this takes a lot of gas. Even not looking at the steel portion, the modern steel industry for any kind of manufacturing, including most of your forgings, which are hot forgings, you have to heat the metal. And that takes a lot of gas, flat out. And Europe doesn't have it, doesn't have the gas. We have a gas crisis for obvious reasons because there really isn't enough gas now in the world. So. And everybody's scrambling for contracts with Russia for oil and gas, all these other countries, which again, to fill the hole, just to understand, to fill the hole that the Middle East has created, or Trump has created in the Middle East, you need another two Russias. Russia produces 11 million barrels, consumes 5 million of those. The remaining 6 million, 6.5 million go on market. And China eats half of that. So... And you've got a hole that's about 19 million, 20 million barrels right now. It can't be filled. It can't be filled by Russia. It can't be filled by America. It can't be filled by anybody else, even if they expand production. Not at this rate, anyways.
So let's actually talk about this. Let's talk about the situation with consumption, with energy consumption, because, of course, that's the other side of the story. We've discussed production. We are going to see this enormous fall in actual volumes of oil and gas and of all sorts of other products. People are talking about naphtha. People are talking about fertilizer. People are talking about all sorts of other products that come out of the Persian Gulf region. What effect is that going to have on production across the entire global economy?
Right. Well, first of all, just to add one more thing, for those people who say, well, the U.S. now has Venezuela. That's great. Venezuela's degraded equipment produces about 800,000 barrels a day. And this is of heavy, very, very heavy sour crude. Sour means there's a lot of sulfur in it. You mix that with lighter crude to make a lot of the to then refine to make your good diesels. But the point is, it's 800,000 barrels. Maybe if you really stretch the equipment to the breaking point, you get up to 1 million barrels a day. The estimates right now to get them to 2 million barrels is about $100 billion in 3 years. Now, this is partially the fault of Chavez and Maduro and their programs that took a lot of the money out of the industry for social projects and not enough to replace. And partially it's from the U.S. that froze up a lot of funds and then refused to ship equipment in. To replace the worn out equipment. It's not damage. It's just simply worn out. So there's no flex there. There's really no flex. Not on a short term. In a medium term, yeah, you know, 3 years you could get it up, but you got to survive those 3 years. There's some flex from the Canadians, obviously, with oil sands. They're going to be vastly profitable now because prices were skyrocketing. But again, they may be able to fix the hole in the U.S. because while the U.S. is a 13 million barrels, U.S. imports oil. It needs more oil. But even the U.S., you're going to get to the point where you have demand destruction, which means simply that prices go up too high. People can't afford to pay the energy costs. The materials that are being produced or products that are being produced get too expensive. People start buying less and you get a deficit going. Depression or a recession. It could easily fall into a depression. And then you get starvation. And this is another point. Quite literally, Russia produces 40% of the chemical fertilizers in the world. Another 25 to 30% was coming out of where? It was coming out of Qatar. Those facilities have been damaged also. So there's going to be a lag time to get those facilities up and running. And those facilities, by the way, are dependent on the gas flowing. So the gas coming out of the wellheads and coming up and being dry, by the way, you got to dry your gas, which literally means drying the gas. Because when the gas comes out of the ground, it has water vapor. It has various other chemicals coming up into it. It has to be cleaned. It has sand in it. You know, just everything is coming out of the ground. It has to be cleaned, filtered, and dried before you can actually use it. So that depends, you know, it's a cascading effect. One fails, the other's going to fail, and systems are linked. Plus, it's very dependent on the wellheads. So you can forget about that for the next couple of years. Well, here's the problem. Southern Europe, it's planting season, ladies and gentlemen. And we have two things, and in another 2 weeks, it'll be Northern Europe planting season. And we have two factors here. Of course, we're talking about, right now, we're talking about fertilizer. But you can't spread the fertilizer on a 100,000 acres if you don't have diesel, because all the trucks run off of diesel, which, by the way, why Russia has a diesel export ban until the end of the planting season to make sure there's enough diesel inside of Russia for all the farmers and at a decent price. Russia will regulate prices and export volumes. They started exporting gas, back in the beginning of January. Because there's a ban on the export of petrol before they have to make sure there's enough during the winter season for all the automobiles. Now, I'm sure it'll come back on because there's not enough petrol anywhere to keep the big companies from exporting everything, creating petrol shortages like we had in 2011 before the government starts stepping in and regulating the market. So for Europe, and not only Africa also, and other parts of the world, there's going to be massive problems of getting enough fuel for the tractors, and then getting enough fertilizer. American fertilizer itself, and America imports, last year imported $500 million worth of fertilizer out of Russia. I'm sure it'll be up with around $1 billion this year. Fertilizer prices doubled, which, of course, is 20% of the cost of your crops, by the way. Not just the fertilizer. Getting the crops to market, that's 20% of the cost. And if that doubles, you know, so your increase is going to be about 25%, or maybe a little bit more. But that's still 5-6% at least increase in the price just for the fertilizer. But it will cascade down because, by the way, you don't have fuel to get it to market. You don't have fuel to get it. Oh, you're paying a lot more for that diesel to get it out in the field. And that's if it just doubles, it doesn't quadruple and it doesn't continue increasing, because the markets are still not fully reacting to the situation. They're starting to react to the situation. Everybody was on hopium, you know, hope this all ends, or on normalcy bias. It'll all be back to normal again. No, it won't. So you may, while I'm not saying there's whole nations in Europe are going to be starving, what you're going to see is actual classes of people starving. The lower classes will be starving. You know, I have a friend of mine. He's a professor of poli-sci in Italy. And I was doing an interview with him a couple months ago, and he was already talking, you know, in the lower classes in Italy, a lot of families can't feed themselves in week three, week four of the month. They just don't have enough money left. And this is before any large price hikes. And when you have large immigrant communities that are being fed by the government, and all of a sudden you have a very large percentage of your population that can't afford to feed itself, and they're looking out, well, why is the government feeding them? That's how you get the social tensions boiling over into open conflict. Not necessarily civil war, but into real open conflict and government problems. So this is going to have a cascading effect. Hungry people are angry. Hungry people are watching their kids starve are very angry people. They're quite willing to spill human blood. That's human nature. It always has been. You know, you can tighten the belt on you, but when you see your children wailing and crying, they're hungry, and you can't do anything to do that, people normally take up the pitchforks, and they take up the torches, and they go to City Hall, and they start burning things. That's been human nature for forever, and it's not going to change. We're going to see a lot of that. What's going to happen in Africa, where, well, Europe can afford to bid up to a certain degree against the Asians for some amount of fuel, Sub-Saharan Africa is absolutely not in that position. They just simply don't have those kind of monetary volumes. There's going to be mass starvation, civil wars, revolutions all across that portion of Africa and other areas. Mm-hmm. So we're in for a hell of a ride.
And of course, there's India too, which is a massive agricultural economy where the people are very dependent on low energy prices and very dependent on fertilizers. Need to import a fertilizer, and India has basically been fairly stable in recent years, but the economy has been growing. It might not be so stable going forward. Is there, let's focus on Europe. Is there anything at all that governments can do in this situation? Because I have been watching the British government. I've been watching the German government. In Britain, they are aware of the problem. I mean, they do understand. I've been listening to, you know, what they've been saying. They don't talk about the fact that there is, you know, that this is really a desperate situation. They're trying to keep people calm and reassured. But they, you can sense that behind the facade of the calm words, there is worry and fear and concern. But I don't see any sign of any kind of plan. In Germany, it's actually worse. There, I get the sense that the German government, at least Merz, the chancellor, he functions in a planet of his own. I don't get the sense that he has any grasp of the situation that's taking place. But let's assume that they all understood that the crisis was coming, that it was really bad, that they had to do something. What realistically could they do? There is some talk now of rationing. I mean, it's starting in Greece. It's been talked about in Britain. Up to this time, nothing has actually been done. There's talk about rolling blackouts, but no visible plan for this. But are these even ultimately ways of addressing the underlying problem, if it is as bad as you say?
You know, the easiest thing that these politicians will probably do is to try to clamp down on their societies. Absolute police state authoritarianism, dispersing with lethal force if need be, any people gatherings, and things like that, which will lead eventually to a major backlash because hungry people are angry people and may spiral into a civil war quite often. And that's the thing that route they're going to go, because that's the route that takes the least amount of brain power, planning, and anything else. We'll just push down on the peasants until they can't breathe, and then we'll hold on to power that way. And unfortunately, that's where I think it's going to happen. Realistically, what can be done? Rationing, absolutely. You got no choice on that. Expelling all the immigrants that are there that are not contributing directly, they're feeding mass expulsions because you don't have enough to feed your own people and these immigrants. Sorry, but now you got to put your own house in order. You can't have the guests over anymore because you don't have enough food for your own family. That's the reality that any rational government will do, because the fact that there are immigrants there that aren't working, sitting on welfare, getting fed, is just going to piss your own people off at this point, because the pie just got very, very small. And the people have been lived all their lives there, have paid into that pie all their lives, and are watching their kids go hungry, are going to go, well, why the hell are they getting free food? All right. The problem is, if you start feeding these immigrants, a lot of them will turn to crime, and then you get other issues going. So the best thing is mass deportations. It's not going to happen, but that would be the logical step. Any government that wants to keep its own population, take care of its own native population. And other countries will do that. Europe, I don't see that doing it. What else can they do? Well, luckily, as far as gas goes, 80% of gas doesn't go to the people. It doesn't go to produce heating and electricity. 80% of that gas goes to industry. So we just cut back on industry. Well, the problem, if you cut back on industry, you cut back on people's paychecks. And when food is skyrocketing, as it will be, and as already is, people go hungry even faster. Now they don't have jobs. And you get a lot more of your own population that's now listless and very, very angry. So again, you're spiraling back to the same thing. I mean, the best thing is, A, get rid of anybody that's not contributing directly, any freeloaders that are foreign. B, be absolutely honest with your people and look, this is the situation we're in. C, I would say cozy up to Russia, but Russians aren't exactly in the best of mood to be cozied up to by regimes that have been trying to exterminate Russia for the last 4 years actively, screaming how we're going to destroy the Russian economy, we're going to bring Russians to their knees. We've got the fantasy maps of 40 different Russian governments split in the place of Russia, and so on and so on. So these politicians, most of them have their bridges burned. I mean, look, Macron's guys try to get in. Ushakov told them what? Pardon my French. Idite nahuy, which quite literally means fuck you in Russian. I mean, this isn't diplomatic talk. This is, you know, they just got told where to go send themselves. And this is from a top position in the Russian government. This isn't some third-rate, fourth-rate politician or some third-rate diplomat. This is from the top of the government telling Macron, go bounce. We don't need you. We don't want you. We don't want to talk to you. And this is the people that are in power. They burnt their bridges. They've danced on the ashes of those bridges. They made sure they could do everything to destroy those bridges. And now suddenly they're going to, but they're still not even crawling on their knees. They're still trying to dictate. Now you can sell to us, you Russians, which is how it's being interpreted in Russia. Like, yeah, okay, whatever. So from the Russian point. So now what do you have left? You have the U.S., but the U.S. can't supply all of Europe without stripping gas out of the American market. You have Mealy coming out there. I'll supply Europe. Well, the only problem is out of the 5.5 billion cubic feet of gas that he produces every day, 4.8% of the 4.8 billion cubic meters is eaten up by the Argentinian people. So, no, he can't produce. He can't supply Europe. Physically, he can't supply Europe. He can't even cover what Europe lost from Qatar. So all of this becomes a scarcity problem. Just so people understand, drill, drill now is a great motto. But just understand, to bring a new field to economic exploitation levels of economic exploitation, 3 to 5 years. 3 to 5 years from a clear field to your first wildcat wells to actual producing wells, well heads, pumps, piping, and everything else to get that to market. And that's if you don't have to go God only knows where. 3 to 5 years.
What do you think of
the catastrophe is here?
Yeah. What do you think is the prospect of the United States stopping exports of oil and gas? It has happened in the past. I remember when it happened. I'm old enough to remember when Jimmy Carter did it. We had we did a program with Ray Tsukano, who thought that it was a very real possibility that it might happen as soon as the autumn. Of course, if it does happen, then the consequences for Europe are unimaginable. But what do you think of the possibilities of that? And is it true, as several people have told me, that the shale revolution in the United States has anyway run its course, and that it's going to be more and more difficult for the US to maintain production at current levels, let alone increase it over any proximate time period?
Well, the shale revolution has been, the U.S. is actually slightly increasing its oil production as of from 2024 to 2023, like 13.8 million barrels. It's not a huge increase. On the bright side, that shale oil is not going to be profitable for once because prices are going up so much. Most of these companies have actually been working just to survive. They're not making any profits. A lot of them are just losing money, investor money. So that's one side of it. And oil, yeah, the U.S. may block export of oil. Gas, I don't see it as much because the U.S. is still producing a lot more gas than it's consuming. So gas and LNG will probably continue flowing. Oil, not so much so. And yes, it's going to be a disaster. It's going to be an absolute disaster for Europe. Europe could start, the European countries could start a World War III with Russia to try to get the people's attention off of it. But it's still hard to do without fuel. If you buy American equipment, you still got to have some kind of fuel to put into that equipment, diesel primarily. Fuel for the M1 Abrams tanks. But the point is it doesn't solve your biggest issue, the fact that there's just not enough fuel. There's fuel scarcity, fertilizer scarcity, food scarcity, because the Green Revolution was built on artificial fertilizers. And just look at most of these fields, you can count on crops dropping between a fourth to half crop yields without the artificial fertilizers. The chemical fertilizers. It's a disaster. It's a disaster. And the longer that the Europeans keep going, yeah, there's no holes in the Titanic. Everything's fine. Never mind, the water level's rising. Just keep playing the band, have a good party, dance along. And meanwhile, they're on Titanic and they just didn't hit the glacier once. They're constantly ramming into that glacier, going back, ramming again, going back again. Yeah, we don't need Russian gas. Well, the Russians are evil. Yeah, we're going to continue funding Ukraine for war with Russia. And those Chinese are bastards over there too, and so on and so on. They're just making the problem even worse. And hoping out that the U.S. will come rescue at its own expense is absolutely futilely stupid. They're not going to ever sacrifice their own country to save Europe. Europe just doesn't matter in the long run for the United States. So I don't know. I don't see anything positive for the vast majority of the European subcontinent. This is a disaster, and they're only going to really feel the full weight of the disaster closer towards summer, especially with a failure in the plowing season planting season. And when the news hits the markets just how bad it is, you're going to see food prices futures skyrocket. Absolutely skyrocket.
Stanislav, I know what I would do if I was advising any of the leaders of Europe, Merz, Starmer, Macron, whoever, not that they would pay any attention to my advice. I would tell them, Prime Minister, President, Chancellor, for heaven's sake, lift the sanctions on Russia. That's the first thing you need to do. And send some people to Moscow now and negotiate seriously, finally, about ending the war in Ukraine. And the second thing you need to do is to send people to Washington and say to them there, for heaven's sake, end this war with Iran as soon as possible. I'm going to tell you straight away, I've spoken to people. Nothing like that is happening.
I would suggest learning what the Russian word chelopabitia means. Chelopabitia. And you get on when the servants go in front of the master, they get on their knees, hands and knees, and they beat their head into the floor and go, oh, great master, please save us, do something. The European politicians need to learn how to do that really, really well. Because they probably may not survive literally, quite literally. I'm not even talking career-wise to the end of this year. Hungry people are very, very mean. Hungry cold people, when winter comes around, there's a Russian saying, Zimanya za garami, winter is not beyond the mountains. You know, kind of like Game of Thrones, winter's coming, and winter's always coming, and winter, and this may be early spring still, but winter is coming, and winter will arrive. And if there's not gas to heat the houses, and you're going to add to starvation freezing, you know, that's a collapse of society. Cold, hungry, angry people are very, very mean. So,
Stanislav, this has been an exceptional program. It's been extremely interesting and explained an awful lot. Thank you again. And I'm sure we'll be doing follow-up programs as this drama unfolds over the next few weeks and months. Thank you again.
Thank you. Trump will definitely go down in the history book.
That's for sure. Stanislav, before you go, once again, where can people follow your work?
Okay, so I'm on X at Stanis Krapivnik. I am on YouTube at Mr. Slavic Man with a K. I am on X. Stas Tudaya Bratna is the Russian channel. Stas was there is the English channel. And I'm on Substack at Zmei Garenich. So all right. One of those places. And I'm using Substack as, by the way, a backup for my YouTube because you just never know.
So. Those links are in the description box down below. Thank you, Stanislav.
Thank you.